Welcome to the History of Chemistry podcast. I'm Steve Cohen, your host, and this is episode 105, Safety First, on the development of safety equipment in the chemical laboratory. Thanks to those who already support this podcast. Support the continuation of this podcast at Patreon. The website is www.patreon.com/thehistoryofchemistry. More than once in this series, you have heard me note that, centuries ago, taking basic safety precautions was not a thing in chemistry laboratories. In fact, the idea of safety equipment is a relatively recent development in the relatively recent science of chemistry. A chem lab was known 200 years ago to be a general hazard, and you became a chemist at your own risk. The early 19th century French chemist, Gay Lussac, was experimenting with Humphrey Davy's new metallic discovery, potassium, and had a terrible lab accident in 1808 that permanently damaged his eyesight, and he needed glasses for the rest of his life. Robert Bunsen was working in a laboratory in 1843 when a flask of an arsenic-containing compound, cacodyl chloride, exploded, blinding his right eye. This idea of a chemist as a scientific martyr continued through the 19th century when Auguste Kekulé himself heard in 1840 and recounted 50 years later, quote, "If you want to become a chemist, you have to ruin your health. Who does not ruin his health by his studies nowadays will not get anywhere in chemistry," unquote. All that said, safety equipment was known even in ancient times. The Roman Pliny the Elder advocated the use of animal bladders for metal workers, and Agricola in the Renaissance also talked of ventilation and masks for metal workers. But overall, in the chemistry laboratory, you took your life into your own hands up to the 20th century. Let's look at the very basic equipment of safety goggles now always required. The Inuit and Yupik peoples of the Arctic invented anti-snow blindness goggles, which included eye slits to limit the amount of light reflected from snowy landscapes. For protection against chemical hazards, the first known safety goggles, though, were invented in 1880 by the American Powell Johnson. These goggles used semi-opaque cloth to block the searing heat and light encountered by furnace operators and firefighters. Not until 1909 were the first glass safety goggles created by the Julius King Optical Company under the brand name Saniglass. 5 years later, to help workers who already wore prescription lenses, did the American Optical Company add such prescription lenses to safety goggles. If you look at the photograph I used on my Buzzsprout website for this series, it's an image of the chemistry laboratory at the Tuskegee University in Alabama, USA, at the turn of the 20th century. No one is wearing any safety goggles, not even the famous George Washington Carver, who ran the lab, whom you can see as the older gentleman on the right. Special furnace goggles were invented in 1935 to block light and heat, but also against flying shrapnel. Really, the use of plastic safety goggles we know of in chemistry laboratories appeared only post-World War II. What about rubber gloves to protect chemists' hands against caustic liquids? These were invented only in 1894 for medical use. Nurse Caroline Hampton was assisting with surgical procedures and found that her hands often had a rash from the antiseptic solution carbolic acid, which we today call phenol. Her husband, Dr. William Halstead, was the chief of surgery at Johns Hopkins Hospital in Baltimore, USA. he contacted the Goodyear company and had them make special rubber gloves for the good nurse. The boxes of disposable latex gloves we see in laboratories the world over are of especially recent origin. The Australian firm Ansell Rubber Company invented sterilized disposable latex gloves in 1965 under the brand name Gamex because they were sterilized with gamma rays, which are beams of light containing extremely high energy photons that can kill microbes. For those who are allergic to latex, wearing protective gloves was a problem for decades thereafter, until non-latex nitrile polymer gloves appeared in the mid-1990s. Nitrile does have extra chemical resistance over latex as well. Today, we can get other rubber-like polymers in glove form with no plant proteins as latex has. Examples include neoprene, polyisoprene, and vinyl gloves. If you have used such disposable gloves, you may remember that they often contain a white powder to absorb sweat that can make it difficult to slide them on. So the first such powder for rubber gloves was lycopodium, which is a powder form of a certain moss in spore form. This was added to talc, a mineral, and used through the 1920s. But it turns out that lycopodium is poisonous, so the spores were removed from the gloves, leaving only talc. Talc was phased out in the 1960s and 1970s in favor of cornstarch. Let's look at the ubiquitous fume hood, where toxic chemicals can be stored and dangerous reactions can be run. Early on, say 2 centuries ago, existing chimneys were adapted somewhat to pull noxious fumes out of the laboratory. Thomas Jefferson, founder of the United States and the University of Virginia, helped design such a modified chimney in the university's first chemistry lab, but there wasn't much improvement for many decades thereafter. Around the turn of the century, Thomas Edison, the American inventor, also used modified chimneys to remove noxious fumes from his experiments on rubber. The first change was at the Technical University in Gdansk, Poland, then Germany, in 1904. In that chemistry laboratory, installed in front of windows, were glass cupboards or cabinets. These cupboards had lighting inside, plus gas lines and water lines. Their front panels were liftable, so you could open them and gain access to reactants and reactions. The first recognizable fume hood was built at the University of Leeds. It resembled a cupboard, and hence, fume hoods in Britain are to this day often called fume cupboards. Vertical sashes opened and closed for access to the chemicals and equipment inside. The laboratory construction company, or LabConco, began selling commercial fume hoods in 1936, in which chemists could insert their hands to do chemical work. By World War II, the organization that later became the U.S. Atomic Energy Commission invented the high-efficiency particulate air filter, or HEPA. At this time, John Weber at the University of Iowa in Ames came up with the idea of a constant face velocity, variable exhaust control for fume hoods. In 1951, H.W. Allier, an engineer at the Johnson Service Company, determined that you can save energy and replacing such filters if you closed your fume hood when it was not being used. Seems obvious to us today, but back then, apparently not. By 1961, polymers began entering the world of fume hoods. The first one-piece fume hood with fiberglass was sold by LabConco, and a decade later, typical fume hoods were made with steel coated with epoxy resin. By our current point in our chemical history, the 1990s, such fume hoods were fabricated using wood pulp derivatives with phenolic resin. If you have been in a modern chemical laboratory, another piece of equipment is the eyewash station. This is often a small porcelain basin with two spouts of water. You place your face over the spouts, and water gushes over your eyes to wash out any caustic chemicals. It seems the eyewash station first appeared around 1920. What about that public visible symbol of a chemist, the laboratory coat? Once again, such a lab coat appears quite late in chemical history. If you examine photographs of chemists in laboratories in the 19th century, no lab coats are visible. Instead, everyone seems to wear formal attire. Again, look at the photograph of the Tuskegee University Chemistry Laboratory. All the men are wearing suits and ties. The first protective clothing is known for sure in the 1500s. There is a Peter Bruegel engraving from the mid to late 1500s showing a laboratory with the assistant working at a table, and he is wearing some kind of protective apron. 2.5 centuries later, we know that Faraday and Liebig's assistants wore such aprons as well. Yet what about the laboratory leaders like Faraday and Liebig? They didn't wear such aprons, for that was the symbol of an underling, a lower-class helper, who gladly got to do the dirty work, unlike refined men of science. We turn to chemistry's sister field, medicine, for the next part of the history. We recall that up through much of the 19th century, chemistry and medicine were heavily intertwined, especially in education. In the late 1800s, surgeons began wearing white coats. Soon thereafter, physicians began using white coats as well, which was a distinguishing mark between true, educated doctors and widespread quackery. Such white coats indicated cleanliness and hygienic practices. Around this time, too, factory workers began wearing protective coats from all the dust and grease, but these workers wore dark coats. Photographs of lab workers at BASF in Germany in the 1890s show them wearing such dark coats, similar to painters. I have seen some chemistry laboratory photos of the 1910s showing people wearing white coats, but this is by no means universal. I have also seen some contemporaneous photographs of pharmacists in the 1910s wearing white coats, perhaps by association with physicians, and pharmacists are, in Britain, called chemists to this day. By the 1920s, the dark lab workers' coats had shifted to white coats. The general guess among historians is that chemists copied from doctors and industry, so that laboratory coats became common by the 1930s and required by the 1950s. Lab coats became so symbolic that the 1952 Looney Tunes animated short, Water, Water, Every Hair, in which Bugs Bunny meets an evil scientist, has the scientist wearing a white coat. These days, while white coats are common, you can also find other colors like light blue or dark blue. Chemical safety in the laboratory, as you can see, is a modern idea. When I was an undergraduate and graduate student, we certainly took precautions, such as the cabinet plus warning system I built for toxic gases. But there was a general breezy feeling about safety overall. It can't happen to me because I'm an expert. I still recall people who rinsed their hands sometimes with benzene, a great solvent, when I was a researcher in England in the mid-1980s. People sometimes brought a cup of coffee into the laboratory. Perhaps the classic eyebrow razor was suctioning liquids by mouth into a pipette, a large eyedropper, which was replaced with mechanical and electric suctioning devices in the later 20th century. As a graduate teaching assistant in undergraduate laboratories, I sent first-year students home to change from flip-flops and shorts in the Texas heat into long trousers and closed shoes. But now, let's talk about the 1990s and chemical safety in the laboratory. The first item to discuss is the international development of the globally harmonized system of classification and labeling of chemicals, or GHS for short, by the United Nations. From 1990 to 1992, a series of conferences came up with internationally recognized labeling standards for chemicals based on their physical hazards, such as explosives, corrosives, and oxidizers. Their health hazards, such as corrosiveness, cancer-causing, breathing hazards, and environmental hazards, such as damaging the ozone layer or toxic to marine life. This GHS requires all chemicals to have on their label the name of the chemical and who is the supplier, a symbol indicating what kind of hazard it is, a symbol indicating what kind of hazard it is in a red diamond shape, the word danger or warning, depending on how severe a hazard it is, what the chemical can do as a hazard, how to prevent or mitigate the hazard. The system came into use during the 1990s and was formally adopted by the United Nations a decade later. It became mandatory in the United States and Canada in 2015 and the European Union in 2010. In this way, anyone can look at the label on a chemical and have a good idea of what problems the chemical may cause. Or so we hope. Which brings us to the next item, the case of Professor Karen Wetterhahn at Dartmouth University in New Hampshire, USA. Wetterhahn was the first tenure-track female chemistry professor at Dartmouth in 1976, and her research group was interested in how chromium, a metallic element, is carcinogenic by damaging DNA. Among her findings was that the chromium plus 6 ion enters cells and gets reduced, that is, we add electrons back to the ion, into the chromium plus 3 form. In the reduction, the cellular products create all kinds of reactive compounds and oxygen radicals that disrupt the DNA. We go back to August 14, 1996, when Wetterhahn was working at a fume hood doing experiments with mercury. She was using mercury compounds that would bind to proteins, and mercury was preferred because the zinc proteins that occur naturally aren't detectable by nuclear magnetic resonance. The mercury-199 isotope, though, is detectable in NMR. To calibrate the NMR instrument, she used a seriously toxic chemical, dimethylmercury. The bottle's label said, quote, "Danger, poison, flammable, causes CNS, central nervous system injury," unquote. A safety sheet noted that one should wear rubber gloves while using the compound. Another safety page recommended, quote, "appropriate chemical-resistant gloves," unquote, while yet another asked for neoprene gloves. She wore latex, the typical glove material which we discussed already. A couple of drops went from her pipette onto the glove-covered back of her hand. Over the next 5 months, Wetterhahn got intestinal problems. Then she had difficulty walking and even talking. By January 1997, a friend at lunch told her to go to the doctor. The blood sample drawn at the doctor's visit gave a mercury level of 4 milligrams per liter, whereas only 200 micrograms per liter can be lethal. Her urine held 234 micrograms per liter. She tried chelation therapy. Only a few weeks later, she fell into a coma and died on June 8th. One hair sample showed a dramatic rise and then slow fall of mercury concentration. The chemical community was shocked by the toxicity of a small amount of dimethylmercury. To this day, knowledge of its full range of effects is limited, and there are only 3 other reported deaths from this chemical. Dartmouth University's environmental health and safety officer hired an independent laboratory to see how dimethylmercury could pass through latex gloves. The result was extremely fast and easily. Both latex rubber and dimethylmercury are nonpolar solvents, meaning the electron density is pretty well evenly distributed around the molecules, unlike, say, a polar molecule like water. It turns out that only a neoprene glove over a laminated plastic glove is able to stop dimethylmercury. The injury and death shocked the chemical community into reviewing mercury compounds and whether dimethylmercury itself should be a calibration standard chemical. Dartmouth University itself was fined and required to adjust its chemical safety rules and plans. The U.S. Occupational Health and Safety Administration, or OSHA for short, rewrote regulations surrounding dimethylmercury. Since that time, chemical safety has grown in importance throughout chemistry laboratories, both in industry and academia. It is less and less likely that anyone can even bring a cup of water or tea into a laboratory, which is now off limits for food. In our next episode, we finally return to the story of DNA and reading its code, where we left off around 1960, and continue for the next few decades. Until then, brave the elements! Thank you for listening to the History of Chemistry podcast.